Well, we might make a start. Hi, everyone. It's really lovely to see so many people here. We were wondering how many people we'd get for our conversation today, and especially in such a really warm and sort of sticky afternoon as well. So I bid you welcome. My name is Chris. I'm delighted to be your host for this afternoon. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Whadjuk Noongar people, who are the traditional owners of this land, and I wish to pay my respects to their leaders, past, present, and emerging. Firstly, in welcoming you, I'd also like to welcome any listeners, because I believe this session is recorded. So welcome to those who are listening online. We're delighted to welcome Rowana Gonsalves for our conversation this afternoon. I believe this is the last of our conversation series that the Centre has for 2019. Rowana is the author of The Permanent Resident, which was published in India as Sunita D'Souza Goes to Sydney, Speaking Tiger, which is a very exuberant title. Mm-hmm. The book won the New South Wales Premier Literary Awards Multicultural Prize in 2018 and was longlisted for the Dobby Literary Award. It is on the several lists of must-read books and will feature in our conversation a little bit later today. One of the short stories, titled The Skit, was included for publication in the recent anthology, Glass Walls, Stories of Tolerance and Intolerance from the Indian Subcontinent and Australia. And copies of Glass Wall will be available for sale after our conversation today. Rowana is also active on our radio waves, her four-part radio documentary series, On the Tip of a Billion Tongues, features on ABC RN Earshot, and it's a socio-political portrayal of contemporary India through its multilingual writers. Rowana has received the Prime Minister's Australia-Asia Endeavour Award, an Australian Writers Guild Award, the UNSW Copyright Agency Writing Residency, the Bundanon Writing Residency, and the Bridge Awards inaugural Varuna Cove Park Scotland Writing Residency in 2019. She is the founding co-editor of Southern Crossings and serves on the board of Writing New South Wales. In addition to all of these, she also teaches creative writing at New York University in Sydney. So I'd love to welcome Rowana to our conversation today. Rowana, it's lovely to have you here.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I had the pleasure of just speaking to Rowana just before our conversation, and I sort of feel like we've already had an interview there, so this is a little bit like part two of that conversation.
The sequel, yes.
Yeah. Rowana, I'd like to start with a question that I'm always fascinated about when I get the chance to speak to writers, and it's that, what compels you to write? And I suppose, can you talk us through a little bit about your journey as a writer and how you came to writing and what keeps you there?
That's a great question. Thanks, Chris. But before I respond, I would also like to acknowledge that we're on Whadjuk Noongar country, a place of stories for millennia. And I feel this awesome center for stories is part of a long continuum of storytelling that has happened here in this place and on this continent for like more years than we can count, really. And so while that belonging has been kind of thrust upon Indigenous people in violent ways, we're still part of a long continuum of storytelling, art making, creativity. I would also like to say a big thank you to Caroline and John and Logan for having me here, and to Chris. I feel very privileged that we're in conversation, so thank you. The question about why I write. Mm-hmm. I write for the reason that a lot of people write, and I would like to acknowledge the wonderful Rashida Murphy here in the audience today, who's a dear friend and a writer whose work I deeply admire. I think I write to read the stories that I can't find anywhere else. You know, that's one of the impetuses, that's kind of the thrust of why some writers want to write. But I also write to render the brightest moments of the things that I observe around me, and also kind of allude to the darkest hours that I not personally face, but what I can observe around me. So it's really about wanting to see myself in contemporary culture and not finding as many stories as I would like, that is one of the driving forces to create those stories. So to create the work that that I can't find, to tell the stories that I can't find anywhere else.
Yeah. And growing up, did you have, I suppose, sort of literary influences whose work you were drawn to? Irrespective of whether you've, like you said, you were able to find yourself in their work or
yes.
otherwise.
Oh, I grew up in India in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Sounds like a radio kind of... there's a radio station that says that, right? The hits of the 70s, 80s and 90s. But we were very much... This was around... I think Midnight's Children had just come out around that time. But we really grew up with... English literature from England, and that was what was legitimized as excellence, as good writing, as good literature, and then American literature as well. So very much, I grew up with Enid Blyton and Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, etc. but a lot of Indian magazines and the Amar Chitra Katha series and Tinkle magazine, Target. So those, I was a big reader. I think writers always come from readers, and I was one of them, one of those kids who loved to read.
Yeah. So I think that way maybe we're starting to get a bit of a glimpse into your practice as a writer as well, insofar as you're practicing as a reader. And that leads into my next question, which is, you know, can you share with us a glimpse of your writing process? So if we had an imaginary video camera, you know, what would your routines, what would your sort of habits look like?
Oh, you don't want to know. waking up in the morning, worrying about the bills, and then trying to do work to pay the bills, and then feeling guilty that I haven't written, and then trying to write, failing miserably, and repeating the cycle again over 25 years. Yes, yeah. But very much, I think... writing is a practice that gets better the more you do it, like with anything else, like playing an instrument. The more you write, the better you get at it. And I have tried to write every day if I can. It doesn't always happen, but I certainly try to write every day.
Now, you were a writer that, you know, some people sort of write as they, or edit as they go and write very painstakingly, and others sort of write to get things on the page and then might go through, you know, very arduous processes of editing afterwards.
Yeah, I used to be one of those pretentious people who thought, you know, I have to work on every sentence right from the start. It has to be perfect. I recently gave up that idea of perfection, and I've decided to just put everything in the kitchen sink on the page in the first draft. I don't know if Rashida agrees with me, but I feel that's a way to kind of suppress the inner editor and the inner critic, which can be quite debilitating. Those voices can be quite debilitating to getting text on the page and trying to finish a story or a novel or whatever project you're working on. So now I try and write a really bad first draft, and then I go back and revise it. Once I have the story down. Yes.
My next question is around, I suppose, insight you might be able to give to aspiring / emerging writers. So here in Perth, we have a fairly vibrant literary community and culture. We were talking about that before. You know, the Centre for Stories acts as a bit of a gravitational point for a lot of those aspiring and emerging writers. We might even have some of those among our audience tonight. What advice or insight could you share with aspiring writers who are at the formative stage of their writing practice? So I suppose who are looking to make that next leap into publishing, or maybe publishing, you know, they might have some, you know, for one or two publications they're making to publish more substantially, perhaps a book. What's worked for you, and equally importantly, what hasn't worked?
Sure. That's a really great question. Can I respond by reading a story?
Of course, yeah. Oh, sorry, we're going to start with that. Yes, please do.
Because it's really relevant to this idea of writing practice and artistic labor and...
terrific.
And storytelling by committee. Okay, so this story is called The Skit. It's a story about telling a story. I won't read the whole thing because it's quite long, but I'll read a section that's also... the story is published in Glass Walls, but I'll read a section of it where it's set one evening in the home of Paul and Rosalind, who are quite a wealthy first-generation immigrant Indian couple. They live on Sydney's affluent North Shore. They have invited their friends, whom they know from Bombay, who are all international students, and they're much poorer in terms of class. So, you know how there's this myth of the classless Australia. There's also this myth that some people have of the classless homogenous immigrant group. Our groups are also striated by class and religious differences and ethnic differences, linguistic differences, etc. So this is also a story about class differences, but the background is it's a Saturday evening. There's a dinner that's been organized by Paul and Roslyn, and there are a group of Indian students who have come to partake of this meal. Okay, I may as well read from the beginning because then you'll get a bit of a sense of it. One November night in Sydney, Rosalind adjusted the dimmer on her new IKEA floor lamp. Her living room was full of the Bombay gang. They had gathered to meet John Greenaway. He was Paul's client and the director of the Australia-India Festival of Culture, Social Harmony and Business. Rosalind had been adjusting that dimmer every time she walked past the lamp, going brighter, going darker, until she was satisfied that the room looked cozy, yet sophisticated, much like the cover of the IKEA catalogue itself. Suddenly, Sushma clapped her hands and said, "Okay, everyone, Lynette has written a skit. She's going to read it out now." Roslyn, by then, was at the breakfast bar, arranging her beef roulade on brand new Belgian crystal. She had been saving up her last packet of Goan chorizo just for tonight's beef roulade. She would welcome John with a plate full of this offering in her left hand. Her right hand she would leave free to place on his back and guide him in. When Sushma made this totally unexpected announcement, Roslyn said, "Sushma, we're expecting John any minute now." Paul said, "He'll be late. He just messaged." Sushma looked at Rosalind for permission to continue. Rosalind shrugged. Most of the Bombay gang were still on student visas, still drinking out of second-hand glasses from Vinnie's and eating off melamine plates while waiting and waiting for their applications for permanent residency to be processed. Lynette was one of them. She was Paul's neighbour from Bombay, now enrolled in an MBA at a university in Sydney. Paul and Rosalind were the lucky ones. They came to Sydney not as students, but on a secondment from Paul's multinational accounting firm. It was Rosalind who convinced Paul that they should stay on, become Australian citizens, because it thrilled her to be anonymous yet striking in the undulating uniformity of Sydney's affluent Lower North Shore. In the background, Elvis was booming through Paul's new Bose speakers. "You ain't nothing but a hound dog." Lisbeth, an accounting student, had just stood up, stretched out his arms towards Lynette, about to ask her to jive. But when he heard Sushma's announcement, he retracted his arms and sat down again. "Oh," said Paul, turning around, "a skit? You mean like a play? Didn't know we had a Salman Rushdie in Sydney?" "Salman Rushdie doesn't write plays," said Sanjay. "Novels he writes." "Same thing, yaar. For any kind of writing, you have to have a good command of the language," said Paul. "I always say, if you have the Queen's English, you have everything," said Rosalind. "If you can write novels, you can write plays," said Paul. "Salman Rushdie, if he tries to write plays, again he will make millions, again he will get a fatwa, again he will marry a model. But Polly, do you really think novels are the same as skits?" Come on, let's hear it," said Sushma. "She's written it, let's hear it." Lynette opened the embroidered cloth folder and lifted a few handwritten sheets of paper into the white light. Lisbeth turned down the volume and turned on the yellow house lights. Lynette nodded ever so slightly. Without taking her eyes off her script, she began to read. It was a dark November night. Suddenly, Rosalind stood up. Lynette stopped reading. Rosalind said, "One sec, Lynette, I'll draw the curtains." When she was done, she sat down again and flicked her hand, indicating that Lynette could continue. So Lynette started again. This was the first time she had ever read her writing aloud to anyone, let alone to a whole group of people. She faltered at the start, her tongue tripping on the opening lines of dialogue. But soon she took the silence in the room for interest and was encouraged. The story was an amalgamation of many stories in the newspapers that year. A girl comes to Sydney on a student visa, attends a private college, and studies hairdressing. Like many others before her, she has been promised permanent residency in Australia, or PR, by her migration agent, by her private college, and by the man who stamped her visa. The fees are more than what was advertised in the brochure. When she complains to the student welfare officer, he is very sympathetic, invites her to his house, and after a glass of Riesling, begins to kiss her. She initially resists, like the good woman of Hindi films and convent schools. But he is cute and keen and accurate. She succumbs to the callings of her own body and his. In the throes of passion, however, he says, "Call me Mountbatten." Then eyes closed, he breathlessly proceeds to call her a stinking curry muncher cunt. She is stunned. She runs away immediately and decides to lodge a complaint of sexual assault and racism through the local courts. He contests the allegations and, playing on the latest match-fixing scandals between India and Australia, he counter-alleges that she was attempting to buy him with sex. The story climaxes with a dramatic courtroom scene and ends with the girl being deported and the student welfare officer getting off scot-free. Lynette finished reading. There were brand new crystal glasses on the coffee table in front of Lynette. The light from the floor lamp made them glow like compliments. She asked, "So, was it okay?" There was silence. Then Rosalind said, "Oh my, that was God, you poor thing. Why didn't you tell us you were going through all this?" Lynette had imagined all kinds of feedback. For weeks, she had practiced witty comebacks to questions about the dialogue, the sex scene in the story, the decision to reflect India through the broken mirrors of diasporic memory. But the assumption that the skit was autobiographical took her by surprise. No, I didn't go through any of this. Again, a silence full of pity and a collective Catholic ache to be helpful. Really? Nothing like this happened to me, seriously. You mean to say you made it all up? It's, what's it called, fiction or something? Yes, she said. So it's not true then? Rosalind got up and pulled the curtains back. No. Sushma's eyes were red from the tears she was shedding freely. Such a beautiful story. You are so brave. I mean, the girl is so brave. Poor thing. Lisbeth said, "Forget your MBA. You should take up writing. See J.K. Rowling? She's rolling in cash. What will your MBA give you? Nothing compared to that." I'll stop it there, but it gets worse. It's a very, very sad for the writer, actually, in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And actually, that gives us a really good reference point for some questions I have for you later, and actually saves my task of setting out that story as well. I suppose insight that you might have for aspiring writers, in terms of, I suppose, in your own writing practice, what's worked and...
I think, as happens in this story, this group of immigrants are very, very invested in the idea of being a good migrant, of putting your head down, keeping your mouth shut, and doing the jobs that your day jobs, and not rocking the boat, not being critical at all. So that's this group of people in this story. And so when this woman Lynette has written a story that is critical, they all try and shut her down. I won't give it away. Hopefully you'll read it. But the idea is, oh, you're presenting a really critical picture of us. You're bringing our name down. And so that's not what we do as migrants. We have to be grateful. And so that's this idea of, I think that's a really big thing that emerging writers, and certainly I felt initially when I was writing, to get past that idea of, what are the stories I should be telling? If I tell the stories I really want to tell, they're going to be so critical and I'm going to be seen as an ungrateful migrant. But I think it's really important to think of of being critical as a responsibility, and that idea of gratefulness does not have to be decoupled from that idea of critique in a participatory democracy, I feel.
So it's in that way to be true to your own
convictions. And I feel that in response to your question about the path, was that what you were asking about the pathways?
Mm-hmm.
I think as emerging writers, we're working in a literary field that where power is held by whiteness. So whiteness is considered linked to what excellence looks like in the literary world. And so to write against that, to write contrapuntally in some ways, to write from below, it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of support from places like institutions like the Center for Stories.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of supportive gatekeepers. And that, it's taken a long time, but now it's finally, I think there are lots of good people in gatekeeping positions in Australian literature today.
Okay.
And which has led to a lot of interesting opportunities for minority writers.
Yeah.
And so I think things are changing for the better.
Yeah.
It's slow change, but I think it's happening.
I think what you seem to also be referring to is the idea of, I suppose maybe that communal aspect of writing too, surrounding yourself with people who might not necessarily see, you know, eye to eye on your work, but might be able to give oxygen to your work.
Yes.
Because I think one of the things you're getting at is a little bit the idea of self-censorship.
Yes.
Maybe even before you get to that level of gatekeeping, as we're an external gatekeeper.
Yes. You have to be comfortable with... You have to kind of... at least it was true in my case, to strip off those layers of baggage of understanding our complicity as immigrants in Indigenous dispossession today, of understanding our complicity in the ongoing colonial process, of understanding our role in a participatory democracy in Australia as immigrant writers who are trying to chronicle the reality of Australia. So there are lots of different layers that one needs to navigate before one even sends work out for publication, I feel.
Yeah.
For really interesting, fresh work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
As a writer, you have to navigate those questions. And you have to surround yourself by people who support you, by your tribe. But I think you use a really lovely analogy of giving oxygen, people who give you oxygen. But I feel before you can take oxygen from others, you have to give others oxygen too. It has to be a reciprocal thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just be an entitled person expecting everyone to support you while you say, oh, no, I'm not the kind of person who likes to talk about my work. Because if you say that, then you're actually relying on the servant labor of other people to do the work for you. So I think you have to be supportive in creating, in contributing to a literary community, and then in turn you will be supported by that community. So it's about giving and receiving oxygen.
Yeah. So I think maybe what we're getting at here then is also that sort of, as I mentioned before, the communal aspect of writing, because what I wanted to ask you was I suppose at its core, I think to be a writer, it's in many ways to to state it very, to make a very obvious point, you have to write, right?
That would help, actually, put some words on the page.
Yeah.
That's a good start.
I suppose what I mean, to mean by that is to find, I suppose, a disciplined routine to write, to sort of, you know, to think things through. I mean, we talked before of, you know, writing as a way of, a deeper form of thinking, sifting through those layers, and then finding those layers through the very act of writing. So in that way, writing is very... has to be, by nature, has to be sort of isolating, personal, intimate. But at the same time, I think there are also things that you engage in by way of professional development, as it were, or just sharing your ideas, refining your ideas. So, you know, attending events such as this, you know, engaging in, you know, mentorship schemes or even, you know, writers' groups, supportive writers' groups. My question for you is, have there been instances in your own work where your interaction with other... you know, not just writers necessarily, but other artists, other practitioners, has led your work, you know, in an interesting or unexpected direction?
Always.
Always. Okay.
you have to, as a writer, you all writing is cobbled together from other writing. All art is cobbled together from other art. We are constantly influenced by the people around us and the art around us, the words around us. Nothing exists in a vacuum. Writing is an activity that you have to undertake in isolation, but you can't not acknowledge that isolation is one part of being part of a larger community, a part of a very fluid, dynamic world that we live in. So yes, always. Of course, you have to write in isolation. You need that time with your words to get them out on the page. But those words on the page are always, they have these strong, if imperceptible, links to other work, to other conversations, and to other writing, to other writers, to other art. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So maybe in that way our conversation is sort of moving towards that, you know, sort of communal, but also, as we were talking about before, the broad business of writing. And what I mean by that is, I suppose, of disseminating your work, you know, finding avenues for publication, you know, sourcing out funding and grants and competitions and so on and so forth. And to bring up something that's been quite topical in Perth probably over the last month, you know, be aware that the news of the recent, you know, intended closure of UWA publishing, in its current form at least, which will have ramifications, I suppose, on the opportunities that are afforded to emerging / aspiring writers. And UWAP is, you know, offered, I think, a really terrific platform for both local and national authors, poets, you know, historians, academics. And, you know, I suppose its closure, at least in its form, will mean the removal of, you know, one more opportunity amongst what many feel as, I suppose, a diminishing net of opportunities and what is already a very, maybe a very competitive space. So can you share with us your views on the challenges that emerging writers face in this climate and the difficulties that you've faced in navigating that space, and I suppose how you've navigated that space?
Yes. Yeah, I'm reminded of this lovely quote by this pediatrician and philosopher Winnicott, I think it's David Winnicott, possibly. One of the things he says is artists and writers navigate two impulses. One is the impulse to communicate, but the still greater impulse of not to be found, you know. So we're constantly, as writers, we want our work to be read. Of course, that's why we write. If we didn't want our work to be read, we would just write a diary and just keep it to ourselves. But if you want your work to be read, you have to put your work out there and get it published and get it seen and get it talked about. But at the same time, there's also the sense of there's a lot for emerging writers and established writers. A lot of writers will say that we're constantly battling imposter syndrome and the sense of not being good enough, and the sense of not wanting to deal with the world. That's why we're writers, because, you know, we're not we want to have that one-on-one connection just between ourselves and the words, but at the same time we also want to be read. So how do we do that as emerging writers who don't have a track record? I would say before applying for funding, it's important to first get the writing done, and then there are a lot of avenues for emerging writers to send their stories to. Short stories, for example, lots of publications like Overland, Peril, Mianjin, and of course Westerly here in Western Australia, Liminal Magazine. There are a lot of online publications in Australia that I would strongly suggest. Island Magazine, Southerly, that writers send in their work once they are certain of the, you know, once they've got it to the best kind of draft that they can get it to. Because you don't really get a second opportunity to send in a third draft of the work you've already sent in. Because, you know, people are short on time and patience. And so I would suggest if you are a writer who wants to get a book published, I'd say start out by sending smaller pieces, excerpts from a novel or a short story to a number of different online magazines, literary journals. journals in Australia and overseas.
And even at that formative stage, and I suppose I'm sort of asking about your experience as well and what's worked for you.
Yeah.
You know, things that, you know, that they might keep in mind with regards to things like funding opportunities, and like I said, even at that, even as they're building their body of work.
Yes. Yes. I think the first thing is you have to be comfortable with rejection. Mm-hmm. You have to develop a thick skin, and you have to expect that for every one grant you get. Any writer will tell you that if they've got one grant, there are like at least 50 rejections that that grant is kind of standing upon. Mm-hmm. So just getting used to the idea of rejection, not taking it personally. So it's not so much that you're a bad person and your writing is horrible. That's why your work has been rejected. But because it's not the right fit, or, you know, they're looking for something else. And next time it will be your turn. Mm-hmm. So just to remember that you just have to keep at it. Expect rejection when it comes to funding opportunities, because it's a really small pool that's sadly getting smaller. We don't even have a department of the arts anymore, thanks to the current
government. The reshaping of the
we're part of rails and
communications and is that the
and transport.
So, and transport.
Yeah. So in that sort of diminishing pool of funding opportunities, it's about getting the work done and then sending it out to online publications, and then getting enough of a publication track record to submit to a publisher, an agent or a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how important, I suppose, have... you know, attending events and things like that, festivals. Have you found that quite...
Completely. I used to volunteer...
Like networking opportunities and...
Yes. Yes. Networking opportunities, I don't know about that, but in terms of actually being part of a literary community, of a literary ecosystem, you have to be part of something if you want to... I guess you have... Just going back to the previous... discussion we had about oxygen. You have to give oxygen first before you can expect to take from other people. And so, yes, definitely, I used to volunteer at the Sydney Writers Festival, and I attend a lot of events. I'm a serial course taker. I take lots of courses online and in person. I do lots of workshops that other writers run, because it is a constant process of seeing the world in different ways and learning new ways to approach certain technical aspects of the craft as well. And so it's a constant process of learning and self-education, professional development, but always with the view that you are part of a larger ecosystem and you need to contribute as much as you are getting out of it, if not more.
So, Rowena, we've spoken broadly of, you know, writing practice, a little bit on publishing, and I'd like to maybe sort of use this to hone in more on your short stories and, I suppose, the form that they take as well. So your work traverses, you know, a variety of different media, so not only writing as printed text, but also, I suppose, you know, the radio documentary series that I referred to earlier. So what I'm interested in is the relationship between, I suppose, narrative form and content, so the stories you tell, and the form and shape that those stories take. And I'm particularly interested in The Permanent Resident, because, you know, you read from that earlier, which is a collection of short stories. So what for you is the essence of good short fiction? Good, you know, if I can...
Yes. Yeah, sure. That's a great question. I think, to me, it has to speak... A short story has to speak a truth... and illuminate a certain moment of life, of experience... through really fresh language. For me, it is always firstly about the use of language on the page, the way words are put together to give pleasure and to give delight and to be illuminating. Not so much to educate and to inform, but mainly to delight and to give pleasure and to be illuminating. So for me, and I think that's the impetus of the Glass Walls anthology as well, which is about stories of tolerance and intolerance from the Indian subcontinent in Australia. It's part of it's the fourth book in a series that Sharon Karen Rundle and Meenakshi Bharat have been editing over a decade, really. They've come out with anthologies every couple of years, bringing together writers from India and Australia, the Indian subcontinent, South Asia and Australia. And every anthology has had a different theme. This time, their theme is tolerance and intolerance. And I think it's really pertinent for the kinds of things we're dealing with as Australians, but also as people in a world that's sadly lurching towards the right, as we've just recently seen. The most recent manifestation of that has been, you know, the recent elections in the UK. But so this sense of wanting to give voice to these really scary ideas of intolerance, really, that we're surrounded by.
Yeah. Especially like your use of that word illuminating. And I suppose what I mean by that is, do you feel, I sometimes feel when I read short stories, that there's sometimes a bit of an intensity there.
Yes.
Because I suppose the scope you're working with is shorter.
Yes.
So sometimes there is, you know, in a way that you might take a longer time let's say, novel length.
Yes, absolutely.
Story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
there's no room to meander and to have, you know, a few different chapters on the quality of the light. It has to be. I mean, nothing wrong with chapters on the quality of the light, but in terms of short fiction, I think every word counts. I guess it's the prose equivalent of poetry.
Yeah.
Don't tell the poets I said that. Okay. But we're all such poets as short story writers.
Yeah. I'll leave that up to the audience, just to be diplomatic. Yeah. But and I suppose the other question is, like, do you pay much attention to those types of terms, like, you know, short story and novel? Because, you know, we talked before. I mean, I don't want to be flippant about this, but, you know, a collection of short stories, you know, makes up like a sort of a novel length piece of prose. And some short stories can have common characters that weave through in and out. So are even those terms useful to you? Or do you, when you write a story, do you think I'm going to start, you know, this is going to be a short story? Or do you sort of start writing and then let that organically take shape?
Yeah. I think for me, it's always been the impulse in terms of the content has always dictated the form that work will take.
Mm.
So I always knew that I wanted to write about being an outsider of Indian background in Australia. But I didn't want to do it over like a long novel length work. I wanted to look at that position from multiple points of view, from different perspectives, and looking at different aspects of that experience. And I thought the short story form offered that access to multiplicity. And so that's why I chose to write a collection of short stories. I also thought it would be much quicker to write than a novel, but 5 years later I was still writing. It's always a kind of a marriage between form and content, but for me it's always the idea that's burning to be rendered on the page that dictates the form of that story.
If we could shift attention to the title, so tell us a little bit more about this notion of the permanent resident.
This title is, I'm really, really proud of it because I worked really hard. I came up with a list of 100 or more titles, and this was like the 105th one that was finally picked, and so it's a big relief. But I think it speaks to the themes of the book, which question the idea of permanence and impermanence, which question the idea of solidity when you come here as an immigrant. You're expecting solidity, you're expecting, oh, finally, you know, none of those terrible crowded Bombay trains anymore. None of that horrible heat. We can relax here in this English-speaking country, and we're first world people now. But it's questioning those notions of arrival and this sense of having arrived, this impulse to keep going back, this idea of the return as well, and how that might be a state of impermanence. Permanent residency is actually a constant state of impermanence because you're constantly navigating ideas around belonging, around complicity as part of an ongoing colonizing project, and you're constantly pulled in so many different directions towards the country you left behind, towards the country that you're part of now. So it's questioning all those ideas and trying to look at the nuances of what it means to be an outsider who's aspiring towards permanency and solidity in a foreign country.
Yeah, I suppose that's very much reflected in the story that you read. And
yes,
again, without wanting, not giving anything away, but in the feedback of her friends, it's sort of slowly,
it's unravels.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
The fixed notions of what makes for a good story and what makes for a good imagined immigrant, that all unravels in this story, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So also a sense, I suppose, of, I suppose one lens through which I looked at that is that the commentary also on that designation of the permanent resident, you know, I suppose presupposes the authority that grants that particular status.
Yes.
Of that.
Yes.
And then we talked before, of course, what it means to be immigrants coming, you know, I suppose being granted the status to stay here, to be a,
yes,
a permanent resident, as
yes,
it were, but also negotiating that with the fact that you're,
yes,
you somehow don't have claims to the country in that way either. You know,
yes,
the sort of the authority that legitimizes that don't quite themselves have that,
yes,
authority if we think about the, you know,
they
the
don't,
indigenous.
Yes, and if someone can bestow this sort of title upon you, of course they can take it away at any time, as we've seen so many times, so many people's citizenship being revoked in many different countries. So it's never that status of permanency, that legal status can be revoked at any time as well.
Yeah.
So even legally it's not permanent.
So it's a good point to sort of talk about the story a little further, but I don't necessarily want to be restricted to this story either, so please feel free to talk about other of the stories in this collection. But I suppose it speaks to me of the predicament faced by a lot of immigrants in that way, and the forms of sort of racial discrimination that they encounter, sort of both blatant and subtle,
yes,
both inflicted from the outside, but also self-inflicted in the sense of by those around you as well.
Yes.
And the way they themselves might, I suppose, internalize the very mechanisms,
absolutely,
of that discrimination. The story was published in the Glass Walls anthology, which centered around stories of intolerance in sort of whatever form that they might take. Can you talk us about, I suppose, this notion of intolerance, and then why it features as a recurring concern in your work?
I think the idea of intolerance is very much linked to the idea of power and privilege. I mean, it is a privilege to be intolerant, really. To say, oh, I just cannot tolerate this.
Yeah.
You have to be so sure of yourself,
yeah,
that you feel like you can get away with saying something like that.
Yeah.
That's why people like Trump and Scott Morrison, they have a lot of things that they are intolerant about, because they have the power to be intolerant. But I think that for me, as they say with the patriarchy, a lot of us women are complicit in upholding the patriarchy in many ways. The same with whiteness and racism. People who are victims of racism some often also can become perpetrators. So to me, I was not really interested in a black and white view of racism or class or any of those kind of black and white categorizations. I was more interested in the complexities of how racism is internalized, how patriarchal structures are internalized, how classist is internalized by people who are aspiring to be what their superiors are or what they think is better for them. So I'm more interested in the way in which our communities are also striated along class lines and completely riven by conflict around language, around religion. That's a huge issue in India at the moment. It's really, really heartbreaking what's happening to our country. So I'm interested in questioning the self and turning the lens on the self rather than, of course, looking at how the broader system that we live in affects us as minority communities, but also what our role is in being complicit in those systems and perpetuating them in some ways, while also being victims of them.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I might use this opportunity to open up,
yeah,
the conversation to the audience. we have any questions for Alana. Yes.
I was going to ask, it's sort of like a skit, for example, even my first story, which was with an MR, so sorry.
That's right.
But the first story, for example, with the girl coming to Australia, meeting Gloria and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
What kind of place were you when you wrote this? Were you kind of wanting to comment on how people of a different background see Australians, see Australia, and stuff like that, or what was the kind of mindset when you wrote this?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. Yes, absolutely. I wanted to look at how these characters were seen by outsiders, by the in-group of, you know, white Australians. But I was also interested in how they see themselves and how they see what it means to be a migrant. You know, to be a migrant, you have to be X, Y, you have to be certain things. And then, so Gloria wants to be the, you know, the ideal good migrant. And for her, of course, that means the rich good migrant. So when it's that Sheetal, who's the beautician, who actually is quite, she's not as wealthy as Gloria. She comes from different class background, different religious and different state background. Because in India, you know, we're all divided by many things, including the states we come from. So Sheetal is from Punjab and seen by Gloria as, you know, riffraff. And so it's about... it's about how you are seen as a migrant, what you think a good migrant should be. So it's looking at all those complexities within migrant communities. So I was in that mindset of how do I explore the nuances of the situations that we find ourselves in. Yeah.
Is that really like the way Gloria in that memory, the tea towel?
The tea towels, yes.
And how I think the main character, what name is this, right?
In the story?
The first story.
I've also forgotten. Yeah.
So she kind of sees, and she comments on the fact that Gloria has now elevated herself from from Indian to that state as a foreigner. It's like she's now
a foreigner. Yeah.
Ascended.
Yes.
So that was kind of a cool kind of. I've never seen that before. So it was like. Yeah. That was a cool concept. I was just wondering.
Thank you for being such an astute reader. And that's
keeping
a great,
you on your toes.
yeah, that's a great question. Yes, very much, because in India, at least someone like me, I thought all foreigners were these beings who had ascended into heaven, and they're amazing, and they're all wonderful and fabulous people. And if you go overseas, you will become them. And so when this woman migrates to Australia, she thinks Gloria is part of this wonderful elite, you know, a group of people who've given up India, like all the riffraff in India, and now they've moved into... Australia is seen as a Western country, at least when I was growing up. And so it's exactly those... That word you use is perfect word. I wish I had used it in this story. But it's seen as ascending into a space of more privilege, into a space of whiteness, very much so, and into the space of... a better standard of living. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Do you have a preference for what you write, short stories or novels, or, you know, a length? Or...
Yeah, that's a good question. The stories in this book are of different lengths. There's like a few pages to like 10,000, 15,000 word stories. It depended on the kind of thing I was trying to say and how far I could stretch the characters and that experience that I was trying to write about. So sometimes I could, that elastic had a lot of stretch in it, but sometimes it was really tight and I had to end it really in just a few pages. I did change one of the endings. It was too happy and they lived happy ever after. So that doesn't happen in real life. Something terrible has to happen.
Husband changed a life. Get killed.
Yes.
I'm really interested in the idea of discomfort.
Yes.
I've bought several copies of your books and given particularly to people who come from where we've come from, Bombay specifically, India generally. And your book has always evoked fairly strong reactions, including extreme discomfort.
Yes. Yeah.
And we are not like that.
Absolutely, yes.
So what is your response to that? Because there's that, exactly like, you know, yes. the girl in the skit, you know.
Yes.
Oh, we didn't know you were going through that.
Yeah.
That's sort of autobiographical.
Yes.
Element, you know,
yes.
when you write in the first person.
Right? Yes, absolutely.
But apart from that, a book like yours, stories like yours, make people from a similar background
yes.
read it. Uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I completely agree, Rashida. And I actually, that is the role of the writer. It's not to lull our readers or ourselves into a sense of complacency about how wonderful we are and how everyone is racist except us wonderful Indians who have the greatest civilization in the world. That's what we were taught, you yeah. know, and in school, etc., that we were the best. And then you come here and you realize that actually the Chinese don't even give a S about us because but in India, like China is like, oh, China and us, we're like really, you know, we're siblings. We're going to rule the world one day. But so a very skewed sense of the importance of the homelands we come from. And so when that is questioned, of course, there's a sense of washing the dirty linen in public, which as Indians we're trained not to do that because of a history of colonization where our communities were demonized and completely portrayed as you know, worse than, not even on the same level as white people, as the colonizers. So coming from that position of insecurity, it's very, very hard to be confronted with nakedness and rawness of the Indian experience overseas, because we have this deficit we're still trying to make up after like over 200 years of colonization. We're still trying to prove ourselves as being good enough or even better than the colonizers. So when that narrative is disrupted, I think, like with your work, it's just, it's stunning because it questions these ideas of what is perfect, what is imperfect. You know, it's all of that. Yeah, absolutely. It's and that is the role of the writer. It is to, that is what literature does. It allows us more than any other medium, more than any other art form, to present these complexities in language which is accessible to everyone. Yes, but I totally agree, Rashida. It is very, very hard to be confronted with a sense of your own frailty as not just an individual, but as a community. When, as a community, as a nation, you're trying to make up for this deficit of being seen as savages, as you know, not good enough, as not worthy.
I was really surprised at the response. Our Western suburbs aren't like your Western suburbs. Our Western suburbs,
the opposite.
Are the rich folk lives.
Yes.
So I remember handing a copy of your book. You have to, you know, as you do with
yes.
your parents, you have to
yeah.
read it.
Thank you.
To an Indian migrant to live
yeah.
in the Western suburbs.
Yes.
And it was a really bad idea.
It was a bad idea. No, I'm glad. Thank you for doing that, because that is a role to be disruptive, and thank you. I'm glad it reached that person. I'm glad it had that negative reaction, which is part of the role of the writer, I feel.
But it stunned me, because that's not how I read
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I didn't read it with discomfort.
Yes.
I read it with joy.
Yes.
And
no,
she
thank
just
you.
Kind of completely lapped.
Yes, totally.
A sense of joy.
Yeah. No, thank you for saying that. And also, I think the other reason, the more sinister reason, especially in times like this, is because, like with your work, we are writing about the minorities in India. We're not writing about Brahmanical patriarchy and celebrating Brahmanical patriarchy in the caste system. Your book is about Islam. You know, my book is about Christianity. And there's no way that I grew up Catholic. There's no way that I make any excuses for the sins of the Catholic Church. In fact, there's a story that completely questions all of that. But it's very much culturally written about communities on the periphery. And my book has, I've been very lucky that the book has been received well. It's been reviewed really well. The only critique that it has had has been, can you guess what the critique would have been? The book is wonderful, but where are all the Hindus? What? Yes. where are all the Hindus? It's like when the ants of the jungle are writing the story of the jungle, the lions cannot take it, even though the story of the jungle has always been about the lions, you know. And so when the ants are writing the story, and it's not true, there are lots of Hindus in the book as well, but the imaginary of the book is about being culturally Christian in a Western country and how that actually is beneficial. It's a benefit that some of the characters in this book have. And it's questioning Christianity, it's questioning cultural Christianity and religion, etc. But when people have power and they're used to the story being about themselves, it's exactly the same as whiteness here. In India, it's Brahmanical, it's casteism, and here it's whiteness. So it's Dalit writing. I'm not at all equating our position as minority writers here to the Dalit question, not at all. We are highly privileged here. But if you speak to Dalit writers in India, they will say the publishers are Brahmins and upper caste, the booksellers, the distributors, the editors, everyone is Brahmin, upper caste. So that is why our stories don't get told, because they don't understand what we're talking about. It's a completely alien experience. And so that idea of excellence in India is linked to being upper caste and being of a certain kind of background. Here, excellence is linked to whiteness. Of course, it's changing, and it's changing for the good in India. It's changing here, of course. But the way Australia is imagined is very much a white country, and the way India is imagined is very much the Hindu nation. And so to complicate that, to suggest there are different ways of looking at it, as many writers have done, including you, Rashida. That is a huge source of discomfort to people who are insecure about their own positions, or who are so entitled that they cannot even see that there are experiences other than theirs. There are many ways to be Indian, just as there are many ways to be Australian.
Do we have any other questions for Rowana? Yes, at the back, please.
I'm wondering, related to that sort of experience, and particularly being asked something like, where are all the Hindus in your story? Do you feel the pressure of being almost an iconic Indian writer in Australia, like you're supposed to represent all Indians?
Yeah.
And everything you say and everything you write is somehow meant to represent your entire...
Yeah. I would love to be an iconic. any writer, the word iconic.
But you know what I mean?
Yes, but I totally know. I totally know what you mean. Yes.
Not white and not...
Yes, but yes. And that is a very valid question. A lot of minority writers get slotted into that category of being the spokesperson for a community. I've been lucky that my book came out at a time when Rashida's book came out, and there were quite a few of us whose books had just come out at that time, and so I didn't really feel that pressure, but certainly I try and only speak from one position and never as a spokesperson. Can't be that, don't want to be that, and it's just not possible to be that. I mean, there are lots of self-proclaimed leaders of the Indian community, but you know, that's just literally one position out of 100 or 1,000 or a billion. Yeah, so that's
it. Do you get that pressure much from other people trying to position you in that way?
Sometimes maybe, like, I know a lot of other writers get asked to comment as an Indian writer. Maybe Rashida, you do here. I think you. Some writers do get asked as an Indian writer, what do you think? I have been asked that, but I try and always bring it back to the stories, the characters in the book, because that really is, at the end of the day, all I can comment on, and all I should be commenting on. Like, I'm no expert on Indian politics or what. I have an opinion, but I'm certainly not an expert or on anything, on fans, you know, whatever. And I can just link it to the stories of the book and the characters of the book. Yeah, but that is certainly a huge issue that minority writers face, because I guess it's like the easy go-to person to get like a quick comment on what's happening. Yeah. And not just culturally diverse, but also, you know, writers who are different in terms of a variety of identity categories always get kind of asked to be spokespeople, but you just can't.
Have any more questions for everyone. I feel like one of the themes of this, or one of the catchphrases, has been oxygen. So I want to give the air to allow for from anyone we haven't heard from before. Okay, I might use that opportunity to just ask you one last question.
Sure.
You alluded to, and of course, feel free to save this if you prefer not to answer. But what next for you? So you mentioned you're currently working on a book.
Yes.
So
I'm happy to answer.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm working on a book. It's historical fiction. It's about Governor Lachlan Macquarie, who was the fifth governor of New South Wales, a colony of New South Wales, from 1810 to 1820. He left in early 1822. He'd served in India for many years before being sent to Australia. He bought two little boys as slaves while he was in India, and he wasn't doing anything unusual. It was part of, the practice at that time for rich white people, but also rich Indians to buy slave labor across the country. So Macquarie bought two boys. One of them, sadly, we're not sure what happened to him, but the younger boy, George Jarvis, named after Macquarie's first wife's brother, stuck with Macquarie, was educated by Macquarie, and then came to Australia, to New South Wales with Macquarie, and went back with the Macquaries, was at Macquarie's deathbed. So the story is about Macquarie's Indian servant. It's reimagining that servant's life, because we don't know too much about him. Mm-hmm. But using the historical details that we already have, the very sketchy biographical details that we have, but then kind of weaving a story around those details. Yeah.
I'm sure we look very much forward to that coming out at some point.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rowena, for joining us for the conversation
today.
Could you guys please join me?
Thank you.